All right, hi everybody, and welcome to this Test 5 preparation class for the junior and senior high. We're going to go over the questions to the junior high test preparation sheets for the benefit of everybody as a review and a checkup on your understanding of the material. So I'm going to share my screen with you, and we'll go question by question and see how you're doing with it. So we begin, of course, with anchor facts. And so the first page of anchor facts is, your prompt is to write a brief description of the event at the date occurring at the date indicated and explain why it is important in American history. So, of course, make the present-centric connection. Okay, number one, 1861 to 65. Bria, go ahead.
Slavery was abolished in America because of the Civil War.
Okay, that's a very succinct answer. That's fine. You could have gone a little bit more elaborative, let's say. So you could say the northern and southern states of the United States fought a civil war, with the crucial outcome being that the United States would no longer have slavery, or something like that. But anyway, you got it short and sweet, so that's fine. Okay, follow up on that, Bria?
I will remember that for sure.
Yeah, okay, all right, yeah. So, I mean, you know, I don't always do this perfectly here as far as the length of the amount of space that you have, but I try to imagine what the answer is going to be and give you the right amount of space. So if you find you've got a three-line answer and you only wrote a one-line answer, well, maybe you could, maybe that'll help you. That's all. I can't promise it'll always be true. All right, number two, circle 508 / circle 509. Anchor fact and its significance, please. All right. Cliff, go ahead.
It was Rome developing a republic and developing a democracy, which inspired our founding fathers to create the government that we sustain today.
Okay, not too bad, right? So the Athenian democracy of 508 and the Roman Republic of 509 produced, or were precedents, could be a very useful word for you to have there, were precedents that used by the founding fathers in their design of the American government. Okay, good. Number three, 1555. What was it? Why does it matter? Timothy, go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. The Peace of Oxford was important to the pilgrims sailing to Plymouth because it said the ruler chooses the religion, which is why the pilgrims sailed to America, because they disagreed with the English form of Christianity.
Huh, that's an interesting one, but it's not present-centric. So it didn't quite come out right. You made a good connection. So that's a kind of integration between 1555 and 1620. So that's an entirely valid thought, but when we say, why is it important in American history, we're talking about how did it lead us to where we are now? So I see how you kind of interpreted that in a more kind of past-oriented fashion. But its importance has gotten a lot greater since then. So that's why just sticking to an episode in the past is probably going to give you only a half answer. So how do we strengthen this answer? That Timothy's, you know, good connection between Cuius Regio and the pilgrims, who still basically believed in that, but wanted to escape from the power of the English king. So how do we connect that to get a final explanation of its significance? What is that significance? Bria, go ahead.
What I wrote down was for that particular part was, this matters in American history only because when people escaping religious persecution in Europe came to America, did progress and tolerance Declaration began, leading eventually to the creation of religious freedom in America.
Exactly. Very good. Very good. So that's the full connection, Timothy. Right? So the pilgrims in America are part of the problem when it comes to religious intolerance. But luckily we're in America and there's an opportunity here to grow and have a different way of life. So we get this growth in toleration, which leads to the best formulation of all is religious freedom. So that's the ultimate importance of Cuius Regio in American history, is that's the European mistake to which American freedom is the answer. Okay, and luckily the Europeans caught on to that one and adopted it too, pretty much anyway. So let's go to number four, 476 AD. What happened? Who cares in American history, Sophie?
In 476 AD, Germanic barbarians caused the fall of Rome. This influenced it to become more European instead of Roman. Thus, the people who came to America were not Roman, they were European.
Okay. All right. So that's pretty good. So American civilization was created by Europeans rather than simply Romans. Yeah. Okay. 1492, please. Oh my gosh. The easiest one of all. All right, Juliet, off the cuff, if you haven't got it written down.
Christopher Columbus discovered America. If this had not happened, no one would have globalized the world or colonized America.
Wow, it doesn't get bigger than this. When you think about globalization, when I think about it, remember how we did that map where I said, if the Civil War hadn't happened... when I think about the discovery of America by Columbus... it is true that following his discovery, others were inspired to do more, and that includes John Cabot, and that includes people like Cabral and Amerigo Vespucci and others. And so there was kind of a slew of exploration that exploded right after that. But it's interesting to wonder about whether or not any of that would have happened, because... the Europeans were going to go around Africa and they were going to succeed in 1498. So imagine the news. I mean, the news had already come back from Portugal. Bartolomeo Diaz in 1488 had circumnavigated, or at least gotten to the bottom of Africa. So everybody knew you could go that way. So it strikes me as possible, maybe not entirely likely, but quite possible, that America would not have been discovered at this time. Simply because there would have been no need to. There would have been, everybody would have kind of settled down and Europeans would have started conquering Africa and instead of, you know, going to America and so on. So it's possible that globalization would not have happened. At some point it would have. At some point it would have, presumably. But it's interesting to imagine how different things would be if it had been delayed by just 20 years, 50 years, 100 years perhaps, Australia, for instance, was not discovered until about 1605 for the first time. So imagine if America hadn't been discovered until 1605. How long is it going to take for Jamestown to happen? Is it even possible for it to happen if the discovery hasn't happened yet? And so on. What are the outcomes? It's staggering to think. So yeah, this is one of history's most important dates. It just marks the entire formation of the modern world in America-centrism and globalization. Amazing. All right, 1648 AD, the final one that we didn't have much of a discussion on, but we managed to get it in there at one point. So anybody bravely ready to do that one? Even after having written about it in your paragraphs? Oh my gosh. The end of the 30 Years' War in Europe, bringing an end to the period of the Reformation and religious wars. So this is crucial in American history because it was during this time that people started to escape from this European violence and come to America. This is the connection that Timothy was making, leading, and then Bria also helped us to make, leading to a society of toleration and freedom. So everything relating to the religion, Reformation and religious wars, whether it's 1555 or 1648 or 1536 or any of it, all of it connects to the idea of religious freedom. Because you've got to have, you've got to have differences between people that uncivilized people would kill each other for. And if you're going to have progress, somebody's going to start thinking this through a little bit more clearly and realizing that there is a civilized way to live. We can give Roger Williams some credit there of Rhode Island and Lord Baltimore of Maryland and a few others like them the credit early on. And then later on, of course, people like the Founding Fathers for taking it further. But we live in a much more civilized time, at least within Christianity, right? We still have the problem of the Muslim world hasn't learned this same type of tolerance and is permeated with a kind of a desire for religious violence still. It's very sad, and, well, I don't know when that's going to change. But it's interesting. One of the best modern commentators on the Muslim world is a former Muslim. Her name is Ayan Hirsi Ali. She's a heroic woman. And it's interesting, she wrote a book, a couple different books, one called Infidel, well, because she renounced her Muslim religion that she was, taught as a child and defected to Europe and then America. And she wrote a book and she talks about, and lately what she's been talking about is very interesting. She says, the Muslim world needs a reformation. I think that's brilliant. I think that's brilliant. And she's absolutely right, because what the Muslim world needs is this change within itself, where all of this pent up barbarism over religious differences finally gets resolved and people are willing to stop killing each other over their different faiths. And that entire civilization needs something like that to happen. I don't know when it's going to happen or how, because we live in strange times. And America has a very strange attitude towards the Middle East. It's kind of like, do whatever you want sort of attitude as far as religion is concerned. So it's difficult for me to see how anything is going to happen in the Middle East to change this particular perspective within Islam, the way that it changed within Christendom. So that to me is, when we talk about the outcome or the importance of studying history, this is where the payoff lies in thinking about how things from the past apply now in a new context, in modern times, and thinking through the problems that we have properly. So I agree with Ayan Hirsi Ali that the Muslim world needs a reformation. How that comes about and who does it, I have no idea, but I don't think that we'll see an end to Islamic terrorism unless either that happens or the United States, as the world police power, essentially smashes every source of terrorism within the Muslim world, which is a quite difficult undertaking. So, anyway, moving on from that to our segment on slavery and so on. Slavery and the Decline of the Union. Number 7. What was the Missouri Compromise? How did it affect the power of the federal government? Okay, Juliet, get us started.
The Missouri Compromise said that Missouri could come into the Union as a slave state, but a new, free northern state, Maine, would be broken off from Massachusetts, and all remaining land from the Louisiana Territory west and north of Missouri would become off-limits to slavery. It affected the power of the federal government in two ways. One, it introduced a separation of power between it and the states, and two, it meant that the federal government could only legally control slavery in parts of the land that were not states.
Okay, very nicely put, very nicely put. So, the separation of powers between the states and the federal government was at stake here. And so, it basically, I wouldn't say it introduced, I think you used the word introduced. I would say that it basically finalized this issue in terms of what could and could not the federal government do with regard to the states and slavery. The federal government had nothing, no say on whether or not a state had slavery. But, as you said, the second issue was, could it do anything about slavery in the territories? And the Missouri Compromise seemed, to say yes. Or at least, temporarily instituted yes as an answer. Right? But as we'll see in the further questions, didn't last. Right, what is abolitionism? Were two famous abolitionists, and what did they do? Bria, go ahead.
Okay. Two men named William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass took a stand against slavery. Because of their belief that all men were created equal, they were called abolitionists.
Okay, so that's close, but not quite everything. So you got the two guys that are in the notes, certainly, and they are, I would say, the two most important ones. But we didn't quite get what they did. Now, you did kind of sneak in the answer to abolitionism, but again, it would be nice to have, my suggestion to you is, answer the question provide an answer that's structured in a similar way as the question. So in other words, what I would say is, give me a one sentence answer. What is abolitionism? So you would say, abolitionism is, dot, 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 and then you'd answer, that's, okay, part one's been answered. Then you'd say, two famous abolitionists were, William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass, comma, and what did they do? And then you would say, well, okay, and Garrison published a newspaper called The Liberator, and Frederick Douglass taught himself to read and write and promoted the message of the equality of blacks and whites, something like that. So it would just, my only thing, what I'm trying to suggest there is just the structure of your answers so that you can make sure you get every part in there. Timothy, I want to hear yours.
Okay. abolitionism was wanting to abolish slavery. One famous abolitionist was William Lloyd Garrison. He created the New England Anti-Slavery Society and he went by the belief that all men are created equal. Another famous abolitionist is Frederick Douglass, who was a slave that escaped into the North. He became a very intelligent man and became a great writer and orator.
Okay, very nice. All right, so that's an example of an answer that's structured the way that I meant, Bria, right? So in Timothy's own words, nicely done. Also, key is abolitionism is not the view that all men are created equal. Abolitionism is the view that slavery is wrong. And you could, you know, then explain, well, for certain abolitionists, or presumably back then most of them, they would take the view that it's wrong because all men are created equal. So that's the reason why they are, that's kind of what underlies their view. But abolitionism is the view that slavery is wrong and therefore should be abolished. So make sure you get the different parts of the question answered that way. All right, let's go to number 9. Explain the Compromise of 1850. Sophie, go ahead.
When Missouri and Texas joined as slave states, a new free state had to join to keep the balance. California joined as a free state, but then the South wanted more territories to become slave states. Utah and New Mexico were created, but the people who settled there could choose whether they would have slavery or not. This was called popular sovereignty, otherwise called democracy.
Okay. Now, this is an interesting answer, and you've got... It's good in a number of different ways, except it's slightly confusing. So what you did was you gave part of the context, which was neat. But it's confusing because when you start your answer by saying, when Missouri and Texas joined the Union, well, you create the impression, which is, I don't think your intention, but you create the impression that you're talking about something going on in 1850. So that's the problem with starting your answer that way. And unfortunately, you also didn't specify the dates of that happening. So it does create the impression you're talking about things that are happening in 1850. You get to the part about California after that kind of intro, but you leave the reader with the impression that the thing you said before also has to do with this. When really what you've done is you've offered up a little bit of background, which is good. But it's confusing. Okay, so that's the only part I want you to notice about that, because basically you got the right answer that California joined. It would have been good also for you to be explicitly say, when California joined, it required the Compromise of 1850. That's what it is. The Compromise of 1850 is the joining of California to the Union leading to popular sovereignty within the new territories. Brio, what's your concern?
No, it's just suggesting something.
Yeah, so I covered that, didn't I? The idea of California joining?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's key. I mean, Sophie got that, but it was a little bit kind of mixed in with Missouri and Texas as prior events and not quite separated out enough. So that's my only suggestion about that. Okay, moving on, because now we get, okay, if we understand our Missouri Compromise, now we have a problem. Number 10, what principle was implemented in the Kansas-Nebraska Act? How did it affect the Missouri Compromise, and what was the result in Kansas? This one got you guys stumped. Bria says she's going to take a shot. All right, Juliet, you'll be next.
Popular sovereignty is the principle that was implemented into the Kansas-Nebraska Act. The Missouri Compromise was repelled, and in Kansas, there were actions taken that almost caused a civil war.
Okay. All right, so structurally, your answer is perfect. You may have simply mispronounced a word inadvertently. So you said repelled when what you need there is repealed. So
yeah,
just be very careful, okay? So
repeal. My dad told me that word, so I kind of was like, wait, how do I say it?
Yeah, right. So, so that's good. It's always good when you are working with a new vocabulary word and you're going to... One of the best ways to learn it is to make the mistake, and then you after that you're always going to know it. So that's fine. So repealed or overturned would be another way to put it, or replaced. Yeah, any of those would do. Okay, good. Juliet, what's yours?
The principle that was implemented in the Kansas-Nebraska Act was popular sovereignty. The Kansas-Nebraska Act also said that in any territory, regardless of its location, the people could choose whether they wanted or did not want slavery. This totally went against what the Missouri Compromise said, however, which the Missouri Compromise, which had said that nothing north or west of Missouri had said, however. The result in Kansas was that both Northerners and Southerners rushed to Kansas to claim it for their side.
And basically got caught up in a civil war. Okay, so don't forget that last part about the violence in Kansas, okay? So it was called Bleeding Kansas because there were these pervasive acts of violence between these competing factions, which created competing governments. And so this was a prelude to the Civil War. Okay, so what you said about it, I think you had it all there. It was a little bit hard to make out that middle part about. So just in essence, what Bria said, right? It repealed the Missouri Compromise because it now allowed for slavery into the north and west of Missouri, which, if you look on the map, is exactly where Kansas and Nebraska are, to the west and northwest. Okay, so there. That's good. Moving on. Number 11, what is secession? How did President Lincoln respond to the secession of the South? Cliff.
I didn't get a whole lot for this, but I think I got the gist of what it is.
Okay.
Well, secession is when part of a country tries to break apart from the motherland. And what happened was the CSA, the southern states who supported slavery, broke off from the United States of America, and President Lincoln responded to this by declaring war. And it was the main cause of the Civil War.
Okay. All right. So, yeah, I can see that you are trying to come up with the formulation here, exactly how to massage those words. So you're on the right track there. So secession is the departure of a part of a whole, or of someone from a group, or in particular in this political context, of course, of certain parts of a country from the whole. And so that you definitely got there. And in this case, it was the CSA, or the combined states that formed the CSA, that left the Union. President Lincoln responded by declaring them to be in rebellion and calling for the raising of troops by the remaining states to force those seceded states to stay in the Union. So that's kind of how I would put it. He declared those states to be in rebellion and called on the other states to provide him with troops to force them to stay in the Union. Okay, so yeah, it can be phrased in different ways. It's interesting because sometimes what you've got is options in terms of the way you phrase something. And sometimes the way you phrase something gives meaning to the events that could really, you know, quite radically change whether or not you understand or correctly interpreting something. And so it's an interesting one with regard to the Civil War. For instance, people have different views of it. In the South, the Civil War is often called the War Between the States instead. And the characterization of the war and kind of the responsibility for it and the blame for it is placed with the North. And so it's interesting how, you know, this particular issue of secession and the declaration of or the call for troops, basically, in the North is interpreted in different places. That's kind of a little technical detail, but I think it's quite significant the way that people view that. So, anyway, let's go to number 12. By what steps was slavery brought to an end in America during and after the Civil War? We need at least 2 steps. 3 is better. Go ahead, Timothy.
The first step was when the South seceded, they were in rebellion and did not count in any vote to change the Constitution. Therefore, the rest of the states took advantage of this and were able to officially abolish slavery in the seceding states. However, the former slave states created laws that if a former slave did not have a job, the government could force them to work as punishment. However, the federal government responded by giving a freed slave 40 acres of land so they could work for themselves since they had training for being a slave. The 14th Amendment was also established, saying that all freed slaves were citizens of the United States and were protected by the laws like everyone else.
Okay, so you did really well in the latter part of the Emancipation process, but you actually missed the first part. So, my characterization of the Emancipation Proclamation is, you know, that it was a limited thing compared to the way that other people tend to characterize it as. I remember seeing it on TV. There was a character on a sitcom that said, "Who freed the slaves?" And it was Abraham Lincoln with the Emancipation Proclamation type of thing. That was, you know, to a lot of people, that's the beginning and the end of the answer. And so in the way that I teach it, definitely, you know, I try to put that in its full context so that you understand it, but I didn't want you to omit it. so what you need there, Timothy, at the beginning of your answer is some mention of the Emancipation Proclamation. Because during the Civil War, right, Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery he freed all the slaves, technically, right, in all the territories currently in rebellion. So that is definitely a huge step forward. And then, given that those states were in rebellion, as you said, they could not, in a legislative way, get in the way of a new amendment. And were not allowed to rejoin the Union until they would agree. And then, as you said, the best part of your answer was how you explained that, well, all right, it's one thing to have the 13th Amendment, but then you have adaptations in the South where you're getting quasi-slavery, and that's really awful. And the Union has got to, the federal government has now got to take additional steps because the South was not willing to let go. So yeah, that was a really good part of your answer. Okay, good. So this is a related question here. What did the 14th and 15th Amendments say? Why were they believed necessary? Sophie, go ahead.
The 14th Amendment stated that all black people in America were citizens and were protected by U.S. law. This was important for the safety of free black people from vengeful Southerners. The 15th Amendment allowed all U.S. citizens to vote. Because of the 14th Amendment, this meant that black people could vote as well. These two amendments started to make black people have the same rights as the whites and protected them like anyone else.
Nicely done. Very good. I like the way you connected those. That was good. Okay. So, moving on. Number 14, what is the Industrial Revolution? Give an example of one of the big changes it involves. So, let's see here. All right, Declan, I'm putting you on the spot. Have you got 14? No 14? I cannot hear you. All right. We're gonna need to do some sound checks at the beginning of class from now on, Declan, because you've got to get this dealt with. So, somebody else, please. Number 14. Cliff.
Well, the Industrial Revolution pretty much was a large and rapid advancement in machines and industry. And one of the big changes was mass production of especially linens and clothing with all the big factories, and production was just sped up. And
okay, so is that a written answer, or is that your kind of off the cuff answer?
Well, I have it written, but it's very short, so I just kind of
yeah, okay, because it has a kind of informal feel to it, like you're making a little bit up as you go along. So I want to just maybe sharpen that up a bit in terms of especially, I mean, you're right about the example. For instance, the manufacture of clothing was radically improved or advanced to the point where people could make thousands of times more cloth and have as many outfits as you could imagine, which we all do, right? So yeah, clothing, the advances in the production of clothing are a great example of the Industrial Revolution. But I think that you're missing something in your definition. And if you don't have this element, you're not going to get a kind of what I would say is a proper appreciation for the Industrial Revolution. When we use words like manufacturing and machinery and all of that kind of stuff, it's just, it's all fine and it's all true, but we're losing sight of something. We're losing sight of the most crucial thing about the Industrial Revolution, why it is so fantastic. Because when you use the words machinery and manufacturing, I don't think that you or too many people have any kind of exalted view of that. You don't imagine it as being some kind of amazing, wonderful thing. Because, well, it seems kind of technical and technological and doesn't quite, there isn't any wonder in that. And I think that's the mistake in having a definition that relies only on those terms. What the Industrial Revolution is a radical advance in human beings' ability to make the things we need to live. That's what it is. If you think of it in those terms, it's much more exciting, much more compelling, and much more heroic in an appropriate way that it is. For human beings to be able to make all the clothing that they need is not some kind of convenience. Where it's all too common for us to go into our closet and pull out the clothing and put it on and not to give it a second thought. But that's the mistake, which history needs to help us get over that. Because we don't understand how wondrous it is, and we don't appreciate it enough that we have all of this amazing convenience. And it's to me, that's what we need more of, is this ability to appreciate it. And there was a comedian who has, I can't post it on the class webpage because it's kind of crass, but there was a comedian who had a routine called "Everything is Amazing and No One's Happy." And he did a hilarious skit about how everything is amazing, but no one's happy. And how pampered everybody is today and how everybody has this incredible superpowers that they don't even realize and appreciate. Which you see all the time when people are, you know, driving in their cars, which are marvels of technology, and people just take it completely for granted and don't really enjoy it. Instead, they end up getting road rage and getting in accidents and, you know, getting impatient in traffic jams. And, you know, you get to the supermarket, if you have to wait in line behind more than two people, you get angry and, you know, so on and so forth, right? Rather than basking in the amazingness of it, which would be a much healthier approach to understanding the food that we have, the clothing that we have. And it's just staggering. It's just staggering. It's wondrous. And if you can enjoy that by seeing it more clearly, then history will be a definite benefit to you individually, personally in your life. So that's my suggestion. Is focus on the fact that the Industrial Revolution is about the things we need to live. We need food, clothing, water, shelter, and medicine. And I'll tell you I'll give you an example, Cliff, as to why in my life, I'll give you a very personal example of how deeply appreciative I am of the Industrial Revolution and why I think it's the greatest thing ever. If without the Industrial Revolution, I probably would not be a father. Because my son was, as they say, stuck. He wasn't going to get out. You know, children, when women give birth, doesn't always go smoothly. And sometimes they're twisted around the wrong way. Sometimes the umbilical cord is around the fetus's neck. Sometimes this, sometimes that. And in the past, that usually meant that the woman died and the baby died. I mean, that's just, that was totally normal for women to die in childbirth before the Industrial Revolution. Because of the Industrial Revolution, my wife and my son are on this planet. So that to me, that's how I think of the Industrial Revolution. Because I got to stand there and I got to put on the hospital uniforms and I got to stand in the surgery in this ultra advanced surgical room with all of the technology there. With the bright lights, with the antiseptics, with the surgical, equipment and the nurses and the expert doctors and all of that stuff. And I watched him come out. I watched them, literally cut my wife's tummy open and retrieve the child safe and sound and sew her back together again and bring him into this world. That's the Industrial Revolution. That's what I think, people don't get enough of is that amazingness of it. So every day, my son is in front of me and I can summon that. When I think of the Industrial Revolution, that's what it is to me. And I also appreciate when I get tired of my clothes. I can donate them to Goodwill and go get some new ones. That's also nice. So it's absolutely amazing. And the same thing goes for freedom, right? Cliff, if you notice and you're looking around in the world, people don't have a clear understanding of what freedom is. And you can also see that they don't appreciate it. People don't seem to get it. That's really sad, right? So being clear on these things and having kind of the right definition can help to spark that understanding and that appreciation. So there we go. Okay, finishing up for today. Explain the connection between means of transportation and the values one needs to survive. So again, there's my formulation there, right? Give an example of how modern transportation makes it possible for you to enjoy a value created far from where you live. Sophie?
Food, water, shelter, clothing, and medicine are the core values people need to survive. To get all of these, one needs some form of transportation. For instance, all the food in my house is brought there due to transportation by car. Since we do not have means to get food if not from a store and transported by a car, we had no means of fast travel, we would have no food.
There you go. Simple as that, right? I mean, the grocery store is, I mean, you probably would have some food, but my grocery store is about 3 miles away. So, I don't know if you've ever known somebody like your grandparents that would tell you, when I was a kid, we used to have to walk 10 miles to school. That used to be a joke in my generation that, the parents and grandparents would say that story and that we would kind of roll our eyes. But, what I like about that story as I look back as a historian is it's true. It's true. And we don't, we don't pay close enough attention to that. And it's so amazing because, sometimes when your car breaks down or your internet breaks down, that's when you really all of a sudden realize, oh my gosh, my life revolves around this technology. I can't succeed in my life without it. My life. So yeah, if I lose my car, well, I can pay a cab to pick me up. But if I don't have that option, I gotta walk 3 miles to get to the grocery store. So that might be a good exercise for you to good appreciation exercise, because you're absolutely right, Sophie. I mean, it's just. But you also didn't mention that how did the food get to the store, right? And how did the bananas get to, your store from Costa Rica? And how did the coconut water get there from Thailand? And so on. All right. So, yeah, from all over the world, basically. Did I do this one? Yes. 16, explain how the communication revolution changed the speed of ideas, i.e. the speed at which ideas can be communicated across great distances. All right, let's finish up. We're over time here. Who's got one? Juliet, do you have that one?
Okay. The communication revolution changed the speed of ideas by reducing the time it took for ideas to be communicated across great distances. For example, the mail service from St. Louis to Sacramento took 22 days. The Pony Express took only 10 days. The railroad took 2 days. But Samuel Morse's telegraph took less than a minute through a code of dots and dashes. And Alexander Graham Bell discovered how to send sound waves along an electrical wire, thus inventing the telephone.
Okay, really nice. So what's the speed of the transmission of ideas now? I forget, it was in the notes. I forget how big it is, but it's some gigantic number that's hard to fathom. Right? So, how quickly is... it's close to the speed of light. I think technically it's about two-thirds the speed of light, because electricity does not... has to pass through a certain medium, and it does meet some resistance. Anyway, so, quickly, number 17. Who marched to the sea? Bria?
General Sherman!
William Tecumseh Sherman. 18. Okay, what was added with Missouri? We all know by now, Sophie. No! Oh my gosh! Not with Missouri! Not at the same time as Missouri! Bria?
Isn't it nothing?
Maine! The Missouri Compromise! You guys, that's so strange! You had those great answers about the Missouri Compromise, and Maine is added at the same time. Okay, number 19. In what war was the Battle of the Alamo fought? Remember the Alamo, Juliet?
Texas Revolution.
Okay, good. And number 20, in the making of clothing, what is the name of the activity that produces thread? My head is spinning. Go ahead, Bria.
Spinning.
Okay, good. Thank you. All right, folks. So, pretty good. I mean, yeah, some really interesting answers. Good answers overall. So, well done. And so, we have, just as a reminder here, the History at Our House April break, so we have a long weekend. We come back on the 22nd, and what you'll see after that is it's pretty much clear sailing, a whole bunch of work there, a steady amount of work until we get to test 6, and basically the end of the academic year on the 28th. All right, that's our schedule. So enjoy that long weekend. Good luck with the test, and we resume the story when we get back. Thanks, everybody. Bye for now.
Bye.
Bye-bye.